Now the head Englishman came into the hospital to check on Billy. He was an infantry colonel captured at Dunkirk. It was he who had given Billy morphine. There wasn't a real doctor in the compound, so the doctoring was up to him. "How's the patient?" he asked Derby. "Dead to the world, but not actually dead." "No. How nice to feel nothing and still get full credit for being alive." Derby now came to lugubrious attention. "No, no, please, as you were. With only two men for each officer and all the men sick, I think we can do without the usual pageantry between officers and men." Derby remained standing. "You seem older than the rest," said the colonel. Derby told him he was 45, which was 2 years older than the colonel. The colonel said that the other Americans had all shaved now, that Billy and Derby were the only two still with beards. And he said, "You know, we've had to imagine the war here, and we have imagined that it was being fought by aging men like ourselves. We had forgotten that wars were fought by babies. When I saw those freshly shaved faces, it was a shock. My God, I said to myself, it's the children's crusade." The colonel asked old Derby how he had been captured, and Derby told a tale of being in a clump of trees with about 100 other frightened soldiers. The battle had been going on for 5 days. The 100 had been driven into the trees by tanks. Derby described the incredible artificial weather that Earthlings sometimes create for other Earthlings when they don't want those Earthlings to inhabit Earth anymore. Shells were bursting in the treetops with terrific bangs, he said, showering down knives and needles and razor blades. Little lumps of lead and copper jackets were crisscrossing the woods under the shell bursts, zipping along much faster than sound. A lot of people were being wounded or killed. So it goes. Then the shelling stopped, and a hidden German with a loudspeaker told the Americans to put their weapons down and come out of the woods with their hands on top of their heads, or the shelling would start again. It wouldn't stop until everybody in there was dead. So the Americans put their weapons down, and they came out of the woods with their hands on top of their heads, because they wanted to go on living if they possibly could. Billy traveled in time back to the Veterans Hospital again, the blanket over his head. It was quiet outside the blanket. "Is my mother gone?" said Billy. "Yes." Billy peeked out from under his blanket. His fiancée was out there now, sitting on the visitor's chair. Her name was Valencia Merble. Valencia was the daughter of the owner of the Ilium School of Optometry. She was rich. She was as big as a house because she couldn't stop eating. She was eating now. She was eating a Three Musketeers candy bar. She was wearing trifocal lenses in harlequin frames, and the frames were trimmed with rhinestones. The glitter of the rhinestones was answered by the glitter of the diamond in her engagement ring. The diamond was insured for $1,800. Billy had found that diamond in Germany. It was booty of war. Billy didn't want to marry ugly Valencia. She was one of the symptoms of his disease. He knew he was going crazy when he heard himself proposing marriage to her, when he begged her to take the diamond ring and be his companion for life. Billy said hello to her, and she asked him if he wanted some candy, and he said, "No, thanks." She asked him how he was, and he said, "Much better, thanks." She said that everybody at the optometry school was sorry he was sick and hoped he would be well soon. And Billy said, "When you see him, tell him hello." She promised she would. She asked him if there was anything she could bring him from the outside. And he said, "No, I have just about everything I want." "What about books?" said Valencia. "I'm right next to one of the biggest private libraries in the world," said Billy, meaning Elliot Rosewater's collection of science fiction. Rosewater was on the next bed reading, and Billy drew him into the conversation, asked him what he was reading this time. So Rosewater told him. It was The Gospel from Outer Space by Kilgore Trout. It was about a visitor from outer space shaped very much like a Tralfamadorian, by the way. The visitor from outer space made a serious study of Christianity to learn, if he could, why Christians found it so easy to be cruel. He concluded that at least part of the trouble was slipshod storytelling in the New Testament. He supposed that the intent of the Gospels was to teach people, among other things, to be merciful even to the lowest of the low. But the Gospels actually taught this. Before you kill somebody, make absolutely sure he isn't well connected. So it goes. The flaw in the Christ stories, said the visitor from outer space, was that Christ, who didn't look like much, was actually the son of the most powerful being in the universe. Readers understood that, so when they came to the crucifixion, they naturally thought, and Rosewater read out loud again, "Oh boy, they sure picked the wrong guy to lynch that time." And that thought had a brother. There are right people to lynch. Who? People not well connected. So it goes. The visitor from outer space made a gift to Earth of a new gospel. In it, Jesus really was a nobody and a pain in the neck to a lot of people with better connections than he had. He still got to say all the lovely and puzzling things he said in the other gospels. So the people amused themselves one day by nailing him to a cross and planting the cross in the ground. There couldn't possibly be any repercussions, the lynchers thought. The reader would have to think that too, since the new gospel hammered home again and again what a nobody Jesus was. And then, just before the nobody died, the heavens opened up. And there was thunder and lightning. The voice of God came crashing down. He told the people that he was adopting the bum as his son, giving him the full powers and privileges of the son of the creator of the universe throughout all eternity. God said this, "From this moment on, he will punish horribly anybody who torments a bum who has no connections." Billy's fiancée had finished her Three Musketeers candy bar. Now she was eating a Milky Way. "Forget books," said Rosewater, throwing that particular book under his bed. "The hell with them." "That sounded like an interesting one," said Valencia. "Jesus, if Kilgore Trout could only write!" Rosewater exclaimed. He had a point. Kilgore Trout's unpopularity was deserved. His prose was frightful. Only his ideas were good. "I don't think Trout has ever been out of the country," Rosewater went on. "My God, he writes about Earthlings all the time, and they're all Americans. Practically nobody on Earth is an American." "Where does he live?" Valencia asked. "Nobody knows," Rosewater replied. "I'm the only person who ever heard of him, as far as I can tell. No two books have the same publisher, and every time I write him in care of a publisher, the letter comes back because the publisher has failed." He changed the subject now, congratulated Valencia on her engagement ring. "Thank you," she said, and held it out so Rosewater could get a close look. "Billy got that diamond in the war." "That's the attractive thing about war," said Rosewater. "Absolutely everybody gets a little something." With regard to the whereabouts of Kilgore Trout, he actually lived in Ilium, Billy's hometown, friendless and despised. Billy would meet him by and by. "Billy," said Valencia Merble. "Do you want to talk about our silver pattern?" "Sure. I've got it narrowed down pretty much to either Royal Danish or Rambler Rose." "Rambler Rose," said Billy. "It isn't something we should rush into," she said. "I mean, whatever we decide on, that's what we're going to have to live with the rest of our lives." Billy studied the pictures. "Royal Danish," he said at last. "Colonial Moonlight is nice, too." "Yes, it is," said Billy Pilgrim.